for a good number of years, and so I hope we can get some clarity at the end of your presentation that we don't have now. So thank you very much.
All right. Good morning, everyone. I am Stephanie Arnold-Pang, and I'm the Manager of Policy and Communications at the National Coalition of STD Directors, or NCSD. And today I will be covering the federal appropriations process, what is it, and what does it mean? So first, why should you care? Yes, the federal appropriations process is a convoluted and sometimes cumbersome process, recently marked by many delays and brinkmanship. But why you should care is this. STD programs at the state and local level rely heavily on federal investments, which are a direct result of the federal appropriations process. In addition, there are significant changes coming that will affect the funding in the next few years, and as a result, it will also affect STD programs across the country. State and local STD programs need to be prepared in order to weather these changes successfully. So every year, the federal appropriations process begins with the release of the President's budget in early February. This document lays out the President's priorities, covering not only all federal spending, but revenue as well. Part two of this process moves to Congress. After the President's budget's release in early February, congressional committees then hold hearings on the President's budget and then work to write their own budgets. This process is designed, in an ideal world, for there to be just one congressional budget, which is agreed to by both the House of Representatives and the Senate. However, this rarely happens, and the two chambers usually have two separate budget documents. And why the congressional budgets are important is that they set the spending limits for the appropriations committees, which are the committees that actually determine where the federal funding goes each year. So after the budget committees write their budget, the process then moves on to the appropriations committees. So they take their funding limits from the chamber's budget and then begin marking up their appropriations bills, which means they begin determining which programs get what level of funding. Then again, ideally, after each appropriations bill passes the full appropriations committee, it then moves on to the full House and the full Senate. Then again, ideally, the differences are hammered out in a conference committee and the bill is sent to the President. But in reality, this process is much messier. Sometimes, either the House or the Senate don't pass traditional budgets. Rarely, as you probably all know, this process is finished by the beginning of the fiscal year on October 1st. So that means the continuing resolutions need to be continually passed by Congress to ensure the government stays open. And then the whole process gets rushed into a few months right before the end of the year when everyone really just wants to get out of town. So this delayed and then really rushed process results in last-minute take-them-or-leave-them deals, which means little can be changed and there's little time for interested parties to weigh in on the impact of the bills. So what are the coming changes to the federal appropriations process? Well, there have been two pieces of legislation that have been enacted in the last 2 years that will have a great impact on the federal appropriations process moving forward. First is the Budget Control Act, which was the debt ceiling deal passed last August. The other, which we've been hearing a lot about this week, is the Affordable Care Act, or health care reform. First, the Budget and Control Act. This was a law that was a deal struck in August of 2011, which raised the debt ceiling, but also included a large number of cuts and caps to federal spending. This law also set up a process of sequestration, which is essentially across-the-board cuts to federal programs, which will begin in January 2013. So these sequestration across-the-board cuts are divided into defense and non-defense cuts, with some impact on mandatory programs such as Medicare and some programs which are exempted from the cuts. Now, there will be a large impact to non-defense discretionary programs through the sequestration process. Now, non-defense discretionary programs is obviously a large group of programs that also encompasses the funding that state and local STD programs receive from the federal government. Now, as this law is currently written, there will be a $38.5 billion cut to the to these programs, non-defense discretionary, coming in 2013. So these cuts would be a 9.1% reduction in funding in 2013. And in real terms, what this would mean is it would be a $14 million cut to the Division of STD Prevention and a $71.5 million cut to the CDC's HIV prevention and surveillance activities. And the sequestration process wouldn't mean just one cut in 2013. It would mean large cuts every single year until 2021. Now, after I've scared you, I should note that there is a lot of discussion in Congress right now on changing the sequestration process, when the process will start, which programs will be affected, exempting more programs. And there is some feeling in D.C. that Congress will negate the sequestration process in some manner before it takes effect in 2013. But the fact is, it's current law, and to change it will mean a change in the law. So the next change to the federal appropriations process coming is the Affordable Care Act. So this law, as we've been hearing this week, will, among other things, expand health insurance coverage both through the private and the private market and through expansion of the Medicaid program. This law also requires private coverage of many prevention services, such as STD testing and counseling. So as a result, state and local STD programs need to start moving towards a billing structure. Now, I know many STD programs are in very different places when it comes to billing, and this will not be an easy transition for many, but it is a transition that needs to start. NCSD is currently working on a number of resources to aid this transition, so please reach out to us if we can be of assistance. But the bottom line is this: the federal government is no longer interested in paying for activities they consider duplicative. And NCSD and other partner organizations are discussing with federal decision makers the importance of this funding and the need to continue key safety net funding after 2014. But the new reality is that Congress will be looking to services that can and are being provided by the private sector and will likely be targeting those lines of funding for cuts. But of course, having said all that, there are two major events coming later this year that could change and affect the implementation of health care reform: the Supreme Court ruling on the constitutionality of the Affordable Care Act expected this summer, and the results of the 2012 election in November. So, in sum, where does that leave us? Federal appropriations will and will continue to be vital to the state and local STD programs, and understanding this process and its impending changes allows programs to better anticipate funding changes. In addition, it is very important that you educate policymakers on the importance of your programs and their funding as you are able. The changes coming to this system are very, very different, and to protect the vital interests that you serve, you need to be involved in the system. So please, if you have any questions or comments, this is my contact information. Thank you.
We have about 10 minutes for questions. If someone has a question, would you please step up to the microphone and ask it? We've had some really thought-provoking financial issues that have been brought up today.
Yes, good morning. I had a question for Kirsten, who loves data. from New Hampshire, right? And one of the best uses of data that I had seen was in Michigan, where they showed their high morbidity areas for chlamydia, and then they overlaid the appropriations committee's districts, and so they were showing the state legislators their districts outlined with the high morbidity areas, their own population, and I was wondering, you know, I know smaller states, maybe it's easier to have those discussions with state legislators, and I don't know if you were having those discussions or you know, any thoughts about how you might be using some of your data with those state legislators about the services that their own constituencies aren't able to access.
I think the answer I give you is we don't know yet, and that's the honest answer. I think right now we're still in the sort of trying to wrap our heads around what happened. Our primary goal is to try to ensure that citizens in New Hampshire who need the services can get the services, and that at the same time we're really beginning to pull apart the data in meaningful ways. And when we have that meaningful data in our hands, then we will sort of begin the, hopefully begin the delicate task of looking for ways to get it to our legislators. You know, we work in a state agency, and I think that there are multiple levels of the bureaucracy in the state agency that require us to really do things in a certain manner, and we're just going to have to do it delicately at this point.
Yeah, I like the euphemism, the delicate task of getting the information to our state legislature. I think that's one of the better ones I've heard, having worked for state government for 7 years.
I'm interested to hear about that, and I think we'll be looking to other states and how they gathered the information, and hopefully we'll maybe be able to duplicate some of that in New Hampshire. So thank you.
Yes.
Janet Arno from Indiana University. Can you hear me?
Yeah, you speak up just a little bit, please.
From Indiana University and Marion County Health Department, Indianapolis. In all of the data presented by the panel, it seems that there really isn't, I didn't see any data regarding delay to time of treatment and number of tests done. And I was wondering if that was part of your data that you just haven't presented yet, or if people are actually looking at that, because I think that's really a determinant of what will happen with disease.
Yeah, I can speak a little bit to that in the Boston work. Is this working? I have a big voice, so I probably don't need it. We did this aggregate analysis, and we're looking at those things, and we're that sort of plan to start right away, because we feel like we have to look at those things. What happens if someone comes in with X? Where do they go? What's the time? We haven't gotten there yet, but we're planning to do that, because we agree with you that's really important, to see if that there is an impact there or not.
Do you know if anyone's looked at delays in care yet?
I don't know. I'm not sure if my colleagues from DPH in Massachusetts, nobody. I don't know if anyone's looked at that yet.
Any of the state reports have any data in them on delays in care that they were reporting as a significant problem that CDC gets? Anything, Tim?
No one knows anything.
Okay.
It's a good point.
Right. Good question.
Allison Muse with the New York State Department of Health. This question is for
you.
Krista.
Need to speak up a little bit.
Okay.
I'm sorry.
Allison Muse with the New York State Department of Health. This question is for Kirsten. I was wondering if with the ER visits, in terms of those 108 that followed the loss of funding, if you were able to look at adequacy of treatment or whether they got treated as an indicator of quality?
Not yet, but we will be. And we're also, we'll be interested to speak to you in particular about the ICD-9 code. That's something that we want to be looking at as well. And if you're willing to share some of your information about how you gathered that data, we'd like to do that as well.
I think one of the key elements of the Accountable Care Act, as well as the patient-centered medical home, is continuous quality measurement and team support and reminding patients when they need to get things done. So it will be very interesting to see how long it takes us to get to the point where that functions smoothly.
Jenny Kane, the health department in Indianapolis, Indiana. In a number of your studies for all of you, I think, when you were looking at the cost, or I think I saw one of them, the New Hampshire one that looked at the cost of chlamydia screening and the cheapest to the highest, a lot of STD clinic programs actually offer free medications. And so are we also looking at that, the impact of, you know, you might screen and see the patients in the emergency room, but they give you prescriptions. And I know probably 70% of the patients that are seen in our public health emergency room, they never fill their prescriptions out because they can't afford the cost. So are you including that in your analysis and your model that you're looking at? Massachusetts as well as New Hampshire.
In Massachusetts, we will plan to when we start looking at the quality. Again, all we had was aggregate data. We had a visit, a charge, and what was paid. So it was all aggregated, you know, by visit. So we weren't able to do that. But when we look at our quality data, absolutely, because that's critical to make sure people got what they...
But how will you know whether they filled the prescription out or not?
I'm not... That's going to be... I'm not sure how we'll know if they filled it unless they did it...
You never do unless you have a closed system,
right,
like a hospital,
yeah,
pharmacy or an,
yeah,
HMO or something that can check,
right,
its own data, and that's the only way you can do it. I know at our institution, the pharmacy records are separate enough from the medical care records. It would be a major data event to try to decide if someone actually filled a prescription.
Yeah, even in the VA, which I know is the most integrated system of all, though they can look at was, you know, what was written, and
So what I'm trying to add to Dr. Arnold's deal is she's concerned about delay in getting a diagnosis, but it won't even matter if there's a delay in them even getting treated. So that's even a longer,
yep,
impact on transmission of disease.
Well, and then there are many steps in there. You know, you get the prescription filled, and then you have to take it. And so, consequently, you've got an adherence issue. So I think you brought up something that's very complex and deserves the continued study that it gets in HIV and the STD world. Yes.
Hi. Thank you. Jose Fessis with Cepheid. I have a question for Stephanie Arnold-Pang about the sequestration process. So the 9.1% mandatory reductions, I guess the question is that based off of the last or most recent approved budget? And then if the cuts continue through 2020,
yeah,
whatever, 25, is that always off of the last, you know, so maybe a 2011-12 budget, or is it 9% reduction from a pre-programmed rate of growth, or just a little bit more clarification on that? Thank you.
Yeah, so just a little more background on the Budget Control Act that I skipped really in 10 minutes, was that the sequestration process was set up kind of as a fallback. There was a committee, a joint committee between Senate and the House of Representatives that was set up to find $1.2 trillion in budgetary savings across 10 years. And basically the sequestration process was an attempt at a scare tactic, I would say, to keep the committee in line, to find some level of savings, ideally 1.2 to 1.5 trillion.
That certainly scared me.
Right. But the thing is, the committee didn't find that savings. They couldn't come to an agreement, mostly for one of different reasons, but mostly because
The Republicans wanted more cuts to discretionary and safety net programs than the Democrats wanted, and the Democrats wanted more change in revenue than the Republicans wanted, and they couldn't come to an agreement. So the sequestration process is the result of that. And so the 9.1% cut in 2013 is compared to 2012 funding. And every year, the percentage changes slightly from, you know, the 9% to 6.1 in the outer, 6 percentages in the outer years. And that's always on the previous year's funding. Because this is trying, it's, the sequestration process is receiving and finding the $1.2 trillion in savings in cuts alone that the Joint Committee didn't come to an agreement on.
Any other questions? Well, I would like to, number one, thank our speakers for putting up with our equipment and